Jennings again, underground. Shortly before the end of the month, Jennings found himself involved in an alarming situation for which he was in no way to blame. The headmaster had arranged for a party of boys to visit an exhibition in London on the protection of the environment. So, on the following Saturday, the 17 boys of Form 3, accompanied by two masters, took the train to London. Mr. Carter divided the party into two groups, he taking charge of 9 boys, with the remainder in the care of Mr. Wilkins. Victoria Station was crowded when the school party arrived, and when they reached the underground platform, the crowds were so dense that there was no room to move. The first two trains were so full that they had no chance of boarding, but when the next train drew in, Mr. Carter squeezed his party into one coach, while Mr. Wilkins' group managed to edge their way into the next coach behind. The boys stood squashed in a tight huddle just inside the sliding doors. Mr. Wilkins heaved a sigh of relief. "We get out next stop," he called loudly to his tightly packed charges. Moments later, the train pulled up at the platform. "Quickly now, quickly," he boomed, urging his group onto the platform. The boys skipped out as nimbly as they could, while Mr. Wilkins did a rapid head count to make sure that all were off the train. 4, 5, 6, 7, and there was Jennings, the last one, about to jump off. Then disaster struck. Jennings was in the doorway when two men, waiting to board, pushed their way in, colliding with Jennings and forcing him backwards into the crowd behind.
Hey, let me out! I want to get off!" he yelled in panic.
Out on the platform, Mr. Wilkins leapt forward to stop the doors from closing. He leapt too late. The doors slid shut. The train started. Through the glass panel of the door, he glimpsed the horrified look on Jennings' face as the train bore him away into the darkness of the tunnel. Mr. Wilkins stood on the platform, rigid with shock. He looked up to see Mr. Carter and his group approaching.
"Carter! Carter! Jennings is still on the train!" he cried. "He didn't get off! I told them all to be ready, and the silly little boy, he couldn't get off!"
Derbyshire squawked in dismay.
"It wasn't his fault! Those two men got in, and he got pushed back!"
"Provided he keeps his head, he should be all right," Mr. Carter said. "He's only got to catch the next train back. He'll guess we'll be waiting for him."
So the party moved across to the other platform to await the absentee's return. The first train arrived, but there was no sign of Jennings. Neither was he on the next train, nor the one after that. Mr. Carter said, "You stay here, Wilkins. I'll take the boys with me to the exhibition. It's only just round the corner. If he doesn't show up in the next half hour, come and join me, and we'll ring the police." So, for the next half hour, Mr. Wilkins stood, distraught with worry, surveying the length of the platform. But eventually he decided it was useless to wait any longer. The only thing to do now was to report the matter to the police and leave the case of the missing passenger in their hands. It was a despondent and deeply unhappy Mr. Wilkins who made his way up to street level to join the main party at the exhibition. Jennings was seized with a feeling of helplessness as the platform lights died away and the train swept into the tunnel. He spent the next few minutes scowling at the two men who were responsible for his plight. If they hadn't come barging in like that, pushing him back, this would never have happened. One of the men was bald and scraggy, wearing a dark raincoat and carrying an unfurled umbrella. He was standing close up against the doors. The other man was much younger, wearing jeans and carrying an airline travel bag. Jennings was standing between them, and, though they seemed to be strangers, he noticed a quick glance pass from one to the other before they turned away and appeared to be looking in other directions. Standing next to the man in jeans was a tall, burly, middle-aged passenger carrying a briefcase. A label on the luggage identified the traveller as Dr. Bernard O'Connor of London, SW. What happened next happened so quickly that, even when it was over, Jennings could not be sure whether he had actually seen what he thought he saw. It was a shadow, rather than an object that flashed past his eyes as the man in jeans moved slightly and the tall, burly Bernard O'Connor gave a sudden start, clapped his hand to his hip pocket and shouted, "Hey, I've been robbed! My wallet's gone! My pocket's been picked!" He swung round in the confined space and grabbed the man in jeans by the arm. "It was you! You've got my wallet! I felt it go!" "Let go of me. I haven't got anything," the young man protested. "I never touched you." "You did. I felt it. You were standing right behind me. So were a dozen other people. If you lost something, it was nothing to do with me, mate." The young man's tone was confident. "You can search me if you like. Feel my pockets. Look inside my bag if you don't believe me." He opened the travel bag he was carrying, held it upside down, and shook it. It was empty. "There you are. I told you it wasn't me. I expect you dropped it somewhere." Dr. O'Connor was baffled. He stood glaring at the passengers around him, helpless to identify which one had picked his pocket. "One of you must have got it," he declared. The other passengers were looking at one another suspiciously and feeling their own pockets to make sure that they, too, had not been robbed. The only passenger to take no notice was the man with the umbrella, who seemed unaware of what was going on. He might have been deaf, judging by his indifference to the scene. Nobody was paying any attention to Jennings, who, for the moment, forgot his own troubles in the commotion taking place around him. He was intrigued by the puzzle of who the pickpocket might be and where the wallet was hidden. If the young man in jeans was the thief, where had he stowed his booty? For he certainly didn't seem to have it on him. But supposing he had an accomplice close at hand to whom he could pass his pocket pickings unobserved, what then? Jennings' mind flashed back to the fleeting shadow that he thought he had seen whisking past his eyes just after the train started. Or was it something more solid than a shadow? An object, perhaps, and he remembered the quick, meaningful glance that had passed between the two men. Could it have been a signal? He couldn't be sure, of course, but he looked again at the bald, scraggy man standing against the doors. He noticed that his umbrella was not rolled, that the canopy was hanging loosely about its frame, gaping open at the top. He edged a little nearer, so close that he could feel the ribs of the umbrella pressing against his leg. By now, the commotion amongst the passengers was at its height. Dr. O'Connor was storming with frustrated anger. "One of you lot must have got it! I shall stop the train! I shall call the police!" Jennings made up his mind and plunged his arm down inside the fabric of the umbrella. His fingers touched a rectangular leather object. He grabbed it and jerked his hand out from the canopy before the umbrella man could stop him. "Here it is!" he shouted above the uproar and held the wallet aloft. "I've found it!" At the same time, the train drew into a station and began slowing to a stop. "That's it! That's my wallet, right enough!" cried Dr. O'Connor as Jennings passed it across to him. "Where did you find it, lad?" "It was in that man's umbrella, down at the bottom." At that moment, the train stopped. As the doors slid open, the umbrella man and his young partner in crime jumped out and hurried away along the platform. Dr. O'Connor made to follow, but stopped in the doorway as the two men became swallowed up in the crowd. "Hopeless! I'd never catch up with them," he said, and turned back to Jennings. "Thank you, lad. That was really smart of you. I'd got just about everything in that wallet. Cash, checkbook, credit cards. Excuse me, but I want to get out," Jennings broke in urgently. "I've got to go." As he reached the doors, they slid shut in front of him. The platform lights receded, and the train was on its way to the next station on the line. Dr. O'Connor was so overjoyed at getting his wallet back that, to begin with, he seemed slow to understand what the boy was so worried about. "Gone past your station, have you?" he said when Jennings tried to explain his predicament. "Nothing to worry about, lad. Just get off next stop and take a train back." "It's not as easy as that," Jennings told him as the train bore him further and further away from his destination. "I'm not sure where to get off. I can't remember how many stops it is, and I don't know the name of the station." He gulped and went on. "And even if I get out at the right one, I might be arrested for travelling without a ticket." "Why haven't you got a ticket?" "Mr. Carter's got it. That's our master. It's a school party, you see." "Right. Well, I'll break my journey and come with you," Dr. O'Connor decided. So, at the next station, they both got out and sat on a bench on the platform to decide what was to be done. Dr. O'Connor said, "Well, if you don't know where you're supposed to get out, do you know where your party is going to?" "We're going to an exhibition about ecology and environment and things at some museum, but I don't know where it is." "Ah, well, that simplifies things a lot. There's an ecology exhibition on at the Metropolitan Museum. I suggest we try there first." As they went up the escalator to the street, Jennings said, "It was a bit of luck, you knowing about that exhibition, wasn't it?" "No, no, not really. It's my line of country, as you might say." "Are you an ecologist, then?" "More or less. My job involves studying the effects of ecology on global weather patterns." They reached the top of the escalator, where Dr. O'Connor paid for Jennings' inability to produce a ticket, and they went out into the street. "Feeling more cheerful now?" the doctor inquired. "Well, yes, and I'm terribly hungry. We were going to have lunch at the exhibition, but the others will have had theirs by the time I get there." Dr. O'Connor considered. Clearly the masters in charge of the party would, by now, be frantic with worry, so there was no time to go to a cafe for a meal. However, a takeaway sandwich bar nearby offered a solution. Dr. O'Connor hailed a taxi, and, with Jennings munching a cheese sandwich and clutching a packet of crisps, they were soon threading their way through the busy London streets. "I shan't be able to stop once I've handed you over," Dr. O'Connor said as the taxi stopped outside the Metropolitan Museum. "I'll just make sure we've come to the right place and..." "Oh, this is the place, right enough," Jennings said, looking out of the taxi window. "I can see one of our masters coming along the street." Emerging from the underground, Mr. Wilkins, rattled with anxiety, made his way towards the exhibition. He'd find Carter, and then they'd phone the police. He hoped and prayed that no harm had befallen the boy. Then, as he approached the front steps of the Metropolitan Museum, he looked up and saw the absentee alighting from a taxi, holding a bag of crisps. There were times, back at school, when Mr. Wilkins was not at all pleased to see Jennings, and would go to great lengths to avoid him. But this was not one of those times. Now he had never in all his life been so glad to see J.C.T. Jennings in person, alive and well, and looking his usual, incorrigible self. "Jennings!" he shouted joyfully with the full force of his lungs. "Jennings! Thank goodness you're safe, boy! Thank goodness you're safe! Are you all right?" Jennings turned to greet him, beaming a wide, triumphant smile. "Oh, hello, sir. Yes, I'm all right. Would you like a crisp?" Jennings Again was written and adapted by Anthony Buckland, read by Stephen Fry, and produced by Anne Hines.